It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This weekend at the Three Rivers Arts Festival, composer and conductor Steve Hackman will lead the Mendelssohn Choir of Pittsburgh in a new kind of choral experience, the Defying Gravity Concert, which will include new arrangements of well-known works such as the Star-Spangled Banner and mashups of Mozart and the Beatles, which you just heard a moment ago. Mr. Hackman, who was trained at the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia, leads Fuse at the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, in which he crafts cross-genre works and performances that intrigue established audiences and engage new ones, bringing classical music to the ears of young people. He joins us now in studio. Steve Hackman, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hey, Paul, nice to be here.
If you have a comment or question for our guest, Steve Hackman, you can call 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm. On Twitter at esspgh. Again, the number 412-246-2002. Have you had a chance to experience Mr. Hackman's work with the Pittsburgh Symphony? Are there mashups that you particularly liked? Is there a mashup that you haven't heard but would like to hear? Feel free to call and suggest it. Mr. Hackman is nodding. 412-246-2002.
Let's get some call-ins. This will be fun.
Okay. Well, that's the beauty of live radio. The listeners can react to us and our conversation. And you are a classically trained musician. How did you come up with the idea for these mashups, which on paper might seem like a form of artistic insanity to some, but when you hear them, they work surprisingly well. They're very effective.
Well, thank you, first of all. It just evolved over time. I've been interested in classical and popular music really in parallel throughout my career, studied both, have created both kinds of music, and have developed techniques on both sides. So wanting to combine them and to sort of forge into this hybrid world, it really just was born out of, you know, making both kinds of music and not really subscribing to the belief that they should be so quarantined from one another.
And you identify the Beatles, your early exposure to the Beatles, as having a great deal to do with this. And a lot of people, certainly over the years, have drawn on the Beatles' influence in pop music. But one thing that they did was to bring classical music, there was a classical influence to their style of pop music.
Definitely. I mean, when you look at the Beatles, you really start to kind of ask questions as far as, okay, what are we calling these things? Because, you know, there's, you know, the Beatles song In My Life, for instance, you know, they asked George Martin to compose a Bach-like, you know, keyboard part for the bridge of that song. Okay, so can you really say that's a pop song, or and it's not classical at all, and it's strictly pop? I mean, it's obviously already a hybrid, you know, but we've sort of, I think, lost that kind of that classical injection into popular music these days, and as well as I don't know that we've got really the popular music coming into the classical side very effectively. So those are the things I'm trying to address.
And of course, when you talk about George Martin, he was the Beatles producer who had been producing classical recordings until the Beatles fell into his lap, and of course, the rest is history. But is this, in a sense, a matter of things coming full circle because the Beatles were so influenced by classical music themselves, and now you're sort of turning it on its head a little bit and creating this fusion?
I think, I mean, possibly. I just think creative artists are always assimilating all their, you know, varied techniques and styles. That's our job, and that's what results in the most compelling and original art. So the fact that George Martin was producing classical recordings, the fact that he studied composition, and that he was able to compose a bridge that sounded like Bach, I mean, that shows you the skill he had. So it's no surprise, then, that you've got, you know, a day in the life with a huge orchestra, and you've got... you've just got compositions.
He's Leaving Home.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, there's a great story about that one too. But all these pieces, I mean, so you've got his influence in there. The fact that he's in the room, I mean, they're not the Beatles without that. You know, Radiohead isn't Radiohead without Johnny Greenwood, you know, going off and you know, studying 20th century classical music and having those interests. You know, not to mention the varied other popular influences all the other artists have. So that's all it is. I mean, the job of an artist is to synthesize these things in a compelling and original way.
What is your process for creating these mashes, as they're called? When you sit down to do, let's say, Brahms and Radiohead, for example, which we're going to hear in just a bit, you know, how do you marry those two things? What is the process for doing that?
The process first is kind of just a gestation period where I listen to both intensely, just kind of have both in my headphones, you know, play them both at the piano and just kind of get them into my subconscious. And hopefully they start to kind of commingle naturally just by, you know, kind of having them both in there living and kind of operating. But then some ideas will come to me. Like I'll be at the gym or I'll be walking around and thinking, oh my gosh, this might go here. And I'll just kind of start to draft a kind of an outline of like which songs might fit into which moments. But then it's a matter of hitting the piano in the case of Brahms Radiohead, because that's a score that I can, you know, play from the piano and just play, go through it and almost play it with an improvisatory mindset. You know, when can I make a sort of segue? When can I recreate something or extend Brahms's music and begin to make a transition into the world of Radiohead? You know, so that's how that one really worked. And there was a, you know, they share some sort of musical elements, you know, and there are particular musical elements that I was able to take advantage of that they both use, you know, musical devices. So
is there something that you look for in an arrangement when you're putting them together, or how does it work? Not being a musician, particularly myself, I'm not very knowledgeable about how it all comes together.
You're doing pretty well for not being a musician, by the way. I was thinking you were definitely a musician based on this conversation. But
well, thank you. If you can fool some of the people some of the time, yeah. I guess.
It's about finding elements in common. That could be a chord progression. That could be a melody. That could be a driving rhythm. That could be an orchestration, you know, anything, just any sort of common point that I can then, you know, draw, you know, connect the two. That's what I'm looking for.
And what are some of the challenges that you know, have you ever tried to put a mash together that you had to just get rid of because it wasn't working for whatever reason?
Well, I should say that, you know, before that gestation period of just kind of ruminating on the idea, you know, there's a very long process of selection of the artists and just of a contemplating the notion, will these two work? I haven't, and generally I would say in that very initial process is when I kind of weed out the bad, you know, combinations and hopefully arrive at a combination that will be fruitful. So far, I haven't taken one on. Like, I haven't started one and gotten down the road and just thought this is not going to happen. There's definitely been isolated instances in each piece where I didn't know how to handle a certain moment, or I got to a specific movement, or I got to a, you know, just a specific section and thought, how the heck is this possible? How am I even going to make this Bjork song work in this Bartok moment? But those end up being the most fun, because that's when you're confronted with a problem and you have to find a creative solution.
So you've always been able to find a way to make it work in the end.
Yeah. Well, yes, in my opinion, it working, you know, of course, in someone else's opinion, maybe they don't think it works.
What kind of feedback do you get? Do you ever hear from any of the artists themselves, the pop artists, because mainly the classical ones are not able to give you feedback. But you know, have you ever heard from, has Bjork ever reached out to you and said, I like what you're doing?
Well, she hasn't, but that's a very new piece. It's only been performed once. It'll be performed here in Pittsburgh in October, and we're definitely making efforts to reach out to her. And, you know, I would love for all these artists to hear it. As of yet, I do have some contact with Bon Iver's people, which is exciting. So hopefully he'll get to hear it, and, you know, we would just love for them to know how influential their music has been and how much it means to me that I take the time to do this.
And how about the audiences? How do they react?
Well, I think generally they react favorably. I mean, I think the people that are interested in coming to a concert like this are already predisposed to liking something like this. You know, the ones that think it's sacrilege to, you know, reinvent Brahms or Copland or Bartok, they're probably not going to come. So I've had very little little reaction of people that come and are outraged, honestly. But conceptually, people, it's when I get the most outrage, I think. I just think on paper, somebody sees Beethoven and Coldplay, and if they're a purist, or even if they're not a purist, they just say, this is a horrible idea, you know?
And what's your reaction to that? What do you say to them or to yourself?
Well, you have to, I mean, I completely understand why, you know, they have that reaction. I mean, I always tell people that, you know, I've studied this music my whole life as well. You know, it's sacred to me as well. These are revered works. So I always have to overcome a certain apprehension when I'm starting these works. You know, when I take a Beethoven symphony and I start to take it apart and start to change it. I mean, I have to get over that too. So I get it. I understand why, you know, purists or even many of the musicians in the orchestra, you know, they just say, why? You know, why are you doing this? So you really have to, first of all, they have to hear it. I think they have to experience it to see that it's well-intentioned, and it's also, it's a reinvention. It's a new convention, you know, just the idea of a mashup. Like, that's a starting place where we're not, if you're talking to a classical purist, they probably don't know what a mashup is. Like, if you think about it, they're busy, you know, listening to Shostakovich and studying John Adams, so they don't necessarily know Girl Talks music, you know, to know, like, this is what people are doing and have been doing for 20 years, you know.
Let's listen to a mashup. And just for people who are just tuning in, we're talking with Steve Hackman, who is going to be, he's a composer and conductor. He's going to be leading the Mendelssohn Choir of Pittsburgh in a new kind of choral experience. It's called Defying Gravity Concert, and it will include new arrangements of well-known works, such as the Star-Spangled Banner, which we'll hear later. The mashups of Mozart and the Beatles, so you heard a little bit of that earlier. And we're going to listen to a mashup of, I believe this is Brahms and Radiohead. Let's listen, and then we'll talk about it afterwards. That's beautiful. That's actually just Radiohead. That's not the mashup of Brahms and Radiohead. But being a big Radiohead fan, that is just an interesting classical choral arrangement of a Radiohead song, which is another way of presenting a popular song to an audience that might know the tune, but is hearing it in a completely different way, and I would imagine gives them an appreciation for classical music.
Absolutely. I mean, this is what artists have been doing, you know, musical artists have been doing since, you know, for almost 1,000 years, taking pieces and kind of applying them to different mediums with different techniques, you know, whether it's Renaissance composers taking folk tunes and creating masses out of them, or, you know, classical composers taking folk pieces and making arrangements and variations.
412-246-2002, if you have a comment or question for Steve Hackman. What do you think of the idea of the mashup? If this is your first time hearing this kind of thing, what are your thoughts about it? Are you a purist? Do you find that this is something that you're not on board with? Or is it opening your eyes to new colors, new phrasing, new ways of presenting music that reinvigorates both of these particular forms of music? Again, the number 412-246-2002, email ESSPGH@WESA.FM, and on Twitter at ESSPGH. When a mash comes together, what is it like for you? What do you feel when you first hear it and it's working?
It's definitely exhilarating and thrilling. I mean, I'm really trying to realize sort of, I guess, my sort of creative space, like the way I hear music, and, you know, so to think to think that a marriage of, you know, let's take a, let's take like Bartok and Bjork, for example, you know, you've got three singers in front of the orchestra, then you've got the entire, you know, 75-piece orchestra or something. So to think in one moment you could be experiencing an amazing 20th century classical piece like Bartok, this incredible avant-garde artist Bjork, and then hearing three vocal harmonies on top of it, to think you could experience that all at once, it is kind of overwhelming. And I guess sonically, I really want to move people, and I wanted to, you know, really kind of attach to their core. So many of these big moments, like the big moment we just heard, you know, they're ideally, you know, kind of transcendental moments, you know. So
412-246-2002. Let's go to Jim in Pittsburgh with a question or a comment. Jim, hi. You're on with...
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. You're on with Steve Hackman.
Yeah, my comment is rather pedestrian, but I was at a party not too long ago, and I had been a subscriber along with my wife to the Pittsburgh Symphony, and we have kids, and so we kind of dropped our subscription because it was... too much time, and we couldn't attend all the concerts. But the guy who was one of the trustees for the Pittsburgh Symphony said, "Well, what can we do to get you back? And how can we, you know, attract people into the you know, the symphony concerts and what have you?" And it occurs to me that, you know, this kind of thing is this kind of mashup is a really great way to get young people interested in the symphony orchestra as, you know, a musical body beyond, you know, like a rock and roll band that is also a musical body, and also to kind of get them interested into a language, a musical language that is different but somehow still related to what is, you know, otherwise popular music. And that's my comment, and that's it.
Well, thank you, Jim. What about it, Steve? It certainly, I think, is part of the goal, right? Is to get the younger audiences excited, and perhaps this is the best way to do it.
Yeah, definitely, Jim. Thanks for calling in and for your comment. I think that it's twofold. It's not only to attract a new young audience who would, of course, understand Bjork and Radiohead much better probably than the established symphony audience, but it's also to get kind of, I guess you could say, maybe lapsed subscribers like yourself. You know, people that have an inclination to attend a symphonic concert, but that are busy, or maybe they just thought over time, okay, we've seen him do it, we understand the presentation, we're looking for something new now. This is always a way I can always kind of go to these people and say, okay, well, this is a chance for you to come back because it's something you haven't seen before. It's a new kind of presentation, a new kind of experience. So it's young and old, you know, but a lot of them are new audience members, which is great.
What can you tell us about the 2016-2017 fuse at PSO season? You mentioned the Bartok and Bjork, and there are a couple of other things that you're doing as well.
Yeah, the Bartok Bjork's in October. Then there'll be a premiere of Tchaikovsky and Drake, which is going to be something.
Yes,
I will say. And if I'm still around after that, there will be a concert in June. Colleagues of mine called Time for Three, who are a phenomenal virtuosic trio, and I've composed tons of arrangements of classical and popular for them.
Well, Steve, I think you're going to be around for a while. The reaction that I've heard from people who've attended your shows has been nothing but positive, and we were excited to have you on to talk about your work. There is a big event coming up this weekend. Again, Steve Hackman is leading the Mendelssohn Choir of Pittsburgh in the Defying Gravity concert at the Three Rivers Arts Festival. And we've been talking with the composer, arranger, producer, pianist, singer, songwriter, Steve Hackman. Did I leave anything out?
Well, I'm glad. It's been great to be here. I mean, this program with the Mendelssohn has been, you know, such a such a great pleasure to put together, I will say, and I hope people will, you know, come hear the Mendelssohn Choir with this stunning vocal ensemble do something, you know, really different and something that was kind of outside of their comfort zone at first, I think. But I think they, you know, they've been amazing sports about it, and now they're sounding phenomenal on this kind of hybrid material.
Well, we're going to go out with a little taste of your new arrangement of the Star Spangled Banner, which folks can hear this weekend. Again, Steve Hackman, thanks so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
It's been great. Thank you.
And coming up, we'll explore the marketing challenges faced by organizations like the City Theater and Pittsburgh Opera. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.